Welcome to New World Notes, edited by moi, Kenneth Doust. We'll start off the new year with a talk by historian Morris Berman. Berman's message is not an optimistic one, but he delivers it with much wit and humor. I hope you'll stay tuned. Speaking of staying tuned, I just junked my stereo receiver after 30 years. It was so old, its radio section had manual tuning. It had a tuning knob and a long illuminated horizontal dial. A pointer moved along the dial, showing approximately the frequency you had tuned. No presets, no digital readout, no remote control. You want a different station? You turn the dial until you find it. It was made in the United States, and it worked reliably for 30 years. This being America, you can't find someone to repair it. And even if you could, repair would cost more than buying a new unit. And that is what I did. My new receiver has a better radio section and a more powerful amplifier. In constant dollars, it costs less than the old one did. It's all digital and push buttons and remote controlled. Needless to say, it's made in China. I do not expect it to work for 30 years. Despite its capabilities and its sleek lines, somehow I'm not feeling any pride of ownership whatever. Just a spiritual malaise, like Jimmy Carter warned us about. Which brings us to cultural historian Morris Berman. For Berman, America is in a malaise, to use the mildest term possible. For Berman, America's problems are not going to be solved anytime soon, not in this century. True, the financial oligarchs are doing their best to turn us all into serfs. But even if we somehow got rid of them all, the fundamental problems would remain. Berman argues that, consistently and going back to the Pilgrims, Americans have lacked any positive sense of identity. We define ourselves only in opposition to something else. Our sense of self and self-worth demands an opponent, whom we make an enemy, whom we entirely demonize. These days, it's Islamic terrorists. For some, all Islam. Before that, it was the godless communists. Before that, going back in time, it was the Nazis, the Hun, anarchists, the South, the Mexicans, the British, and, of course, the savage Indians. We have no sense of self except in righteous opposition to the day's enemy, and we elevate the enemy to agents of the devil himself. The result is eternal conflict, belligerence, and ruthlessness, which we direct against each other, in addition to the official enemy du jour. Berman argues all this in his new book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. And he summarized all this in the first half of a long talk he gave in Seattle in November 2011. That's the background for what we'll hear now. Our selection today comes from later in the talk. Here he argues the position that all major American institutions are corrupt. He gives 13 examples. In conclusion, he quotes a French critic who says that the best metaphor to describe Americans is the werewolf. Berman's main message is one of gloom and doom, but he delivers it with such wit and humor that you can't help enjoying listening to him. With 13 ways America is going to hell in a handbasket, here is Morris Berman.
Criticism is not possible in a Manichaean world, of course, and the U.S. is very good at marginalizing writers who attempt to write a critique of the country in a fundamental way. Overt censorship, as a result, is not really necessary. I get this question all the time when I talk in Latin America. Well, aren't your works censored? I said, there's no need for it. The flood of information is so huge, how am I going to even get noticed? You know, I mean, it would be like, you know, a sledgehammer to kill a fly. Why would they even bother, you know? Famous last words. But yeah. The result is that, as in the famous Goya painting, which you, if you go to Madrid, go to the Prado, Saturn devouring his son. It's a great Saturno devorando su hijo. It's really powerful. 1818. So it's really a horrifying painting. You have to see this. But the United States is now imploding. It's now eating itself alive. That's what's been going on. I argued this in Dark Ages America in 2006. The data for this that have accumulated since then are quite enormous. There is not a single American institution that is not seriously corrupt. I could document this for hours, but again, you've got other things to do. Let me just cite a few examples. First, Ronald Dworkin, one of America's leading intellectuals, did an essay a few months ago in the New York Review of Books showing that the Supreme Court has become a court of men and not of laws. In the case of 5 out of the 9 justices, he says, decisions are made in advance in a right-wing political direction, and then the justification for the decisions is trotted out after the fact, even though it often violates the Constitution. Well, what kind of a court is this? It's a kangaroo court. Number two, in the book Academically Adrift, sociologists Richard Aram and Josipa Roxa report that after 2 years of college, 45% of American students haven't learned anything, and after 4 years, 36% haven't learned anything. Including in what they didn't learn is any kind of critical, analytical, reasoning, ability, skills. They don't have it. They don't know what the difference is between an argument and an opinion, and they don't know what evidence is. They literally have no idea. Most of the students, when asked, defined their college experience as social rather than academic or intellectual. That was what they were there for, to meet people, make friends, get laid, drink a lot of alcohol, and so on and so forth. Half the students in the study said they hadn't taken a single course in the previous semester that required more than 20 pages of writing. A third said they hadn't taken a course requiring more than 40 pages of reading. What were they doing? You know, watching videos? I mean, no idea. A Marist poll released July 4th of this year showed that 42% of American adults are unaware that the U.S. declared its independence in 1776. 42%. And when you go to the below 30 age group, it rises to 69%. Okay. 25% of Americans don't know from which country the United States seceded. Bulgaria? You know? Ghana? A recent Newsweek poll revealed that 73% of Americans can't give the official version of why we fought the Cold War, let alone the real version. But they can't give the official version of that. And 44% are unable to say what the Bill of Rights is. A poll taken in the Oklahoma public school system, this just a few months ago, turned up the fact that 77% of the students didn't know who George Washington was. 77%. In a number of cities, libraries have closed for lack of funding, but I also think it's probably for lack of interest. I mean, who wants to bother with books? So last January, one serious presidential candidate praised the founding fathers for, quote, working tirelessly to abolish slavery. Now, it turns out that these founding fathers declared that a black person legally constituted 60% of a human being, and they enshrined slavery in the Constitution. This person also claimed that the United States government was colluding with the Chinese to abolish the dollar, and on August 18th, after her straw poll victory in Iowa, she asserted that the American people are, present tense, concerned about the rise of the Soviet Union. I was puzzled that she didn't mention Hitler. I understand that he's poised to invade Poland at any moment, you know. This person, Michelle Bachmann, is essentially a dimwit. In the recent GOP debates, presidential GOP debates, she made the statement, Obama has invaded Libya and now he's thinking of moving on to Africa. Where did she think Libya was? In Northern Europe? The interesting thing is not that she's a nutcase. The interesting thing is that millions of people regard her as presidential material. They are your neighbors, folks. When you go to borrow a cup of sugar, you're talking to them. You know, they're your neighbors. You know. This is not in some hinterland. This is, you know, right here. The new high school curriculum in American history in Texas does not have any units on Washington, Adams, or Thomas Jefferson, but it does have a study unit on Estée Lauder. When I, you know, it was like reading The Onion, you know, that satire. When I first read that, I said, oh, this is a joke. This is a joke. But satire has become reality in the United States. I looked more closely. I mean, I saw it, I think, in Common Dreams. I looked more closely. That article appeared in the Austin Statesman. I mean, it really is true, you know. And I've been thinking of, you know, writing a letter to the Board of Education in Texas suggesting that they eliminate the unit on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which I'm sure they don't have anyway, and putting in a major unit on Kim Kardashian, you know. And you laugh, but it's only a couple of years away. Yeah. You know, I mean, this satire becomes reality in the United States. Why not? I mean, you go to CNN.com, and there are articles about Kim's rear end, her psoriasis, her wedding, her divorce. Why not? When, you know, if Estee Lauder can make it, I don't see why Kim should be excluded. Anyway, this factor of the stupidity of the American public, again, is not something that Michael Moore, Chomsky, and the others point out because it's politically incorrect, and it's very impolite to say it. But I did find one besides me, a political scientist named Philip Green, who did an article this year called Farewell to Democracy, in which he wrote, what has seized a critical mass of Americans is historical amnesia and intellectual vacuity. The result is a politics of social self-destruction. What could be more obvious, really? Really? Three, in the aftermath of the crash of 2008, the very people who promulgated the ideology that led to the crash got appointed the president's economic advisors. The fox now guards the hen house. Lawrence Summers, Timothy Geithner, Ben Bernanke, the whole crowd. Not a single Wall Street financial leader has faced jail. Major corporate figures who brought the economy down were in fact awarded huge bonuses. Some secured prestigious appointments at places such as Johns Hopkins University and the Brookings Institution. I couldn't get a job as a janitor at the Brookings Institution, and let's be clear about that. Meanwhile, the very practices that led to the crash, such as derivatives, credit default swaps, and all that sort of stuff, are now being pursued with more vigor than they were prior to the crash. It's not that, you know, they, oh, we can't do this because it, no, no. You know, it's more of the same. Paul Krugman asks somewhat rhetorically, how is it that in the wake of the obvious failure of casino capitalism and neoliberalism, the blame for the crash is not put on the banks, which received finally bailouts of roughly $19 trillion, and the corporations, but on the public sector? So you have the crash because of the private sector and all the blame directed out to the government. You know. Fourth, between 1987 and 2007, the number of Americans that are so disabled by mental disorders that they qualified for supplementary security income or Social Security disability insurance increased 2.5 times, so that one out of every six Americans now falls into this category. For children, the increase is 35 times during the same period. That's our future. Mental illness is now the leading cause of disability among the child population of the United States. A survey of American adults conducted by the National Institute of Mental Health over 2001-2003 found that 46% of them met the criteria of the American Psychiatric Association for being mentally ill. 10% of Americans over the age of 6 now take antidepressants. Actually, it stretches back to at least age 4 now. Toddlers are taking Prozac. And I read elsewhere that in terms of the global market, in terms of volumes of sales, American consumption of antidepressants is 2/3 of the entire world's consumption. So here's a country with less than 5% of the world's population taking 67% of the antidepressant drugs. This has got to tell you something about the United States. Some time ago, actually, there's a friend of mine in England when I was there. She is an art consultant. She lived for many years in New York City, and she bought a plaque when she was there. I don't know. So there's no Woolworths, but it was a store like Woolworths. And the plaque says, "Evenings at 7 in the Parish Hall." That's the title. And underneath it, it says, "Monday, alcoholics. Tuesday, abused spouses. Wednesday, eating disorders. Thursday, drug addiction. Friday, teen suicide. Saturday, soup kitchen, and then finally the Sunday sermon at 9 a.m., America's joyous future." Yes, we have some joyous future coming up. Five, the infrastructure in the United States is crumbling, and there's no money to fix it. Also, in some cases, ideological opposition to fixing it is very strong. apparently the levees of New Orleans are in the same shape now that they were before Katrina. I read an article some time ago about the attempt to address this. Now, I don't know whether it was on the municipal level of New Orleans or the state level. I can't remember exactly, and I didn't save the article. But the councilman stated that they did not want to move on it because it would require a cooperative effort, and this, they said, meant socialism. So apparently working together is equivalent to socialism, and it's better to risk another Katrina than to have that. You know, boy, it doesn't get dumber than that. You know, I mean, it's limited. Number six, the national debt now stands at more than $14 trillion. The official figure for poverty and hunger is 45 million citizens, but in fact that's based on criteria that are pretty much obsolete. In fact, something like 200 million Americans live from paycheck to paycheck if they can get a job. As far as that goes, it's, don't believe those figures about 9% unemployment. It's close to 20 in real figures. And this is verified by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. If you go to the website of the U.S. Department of Labor, you'll find it. It's like 18%, which means that one out of five Americans are out of work, and economists say there's little chance they're going to find it for another 10 years. Not a rosy prospect. Seven, the president now has the right, although it violates the Geneva Accords, to designate any American citizen, or actually anyone on the planet, an enemy, and have him or her assassinated. In fact, that recently happened on September 30th. Obama had two American citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, murdered, you know. And one can say, you know, well, they were al-Qaeda supporters and so on. First of all, that's not proven. And the second thing is, so what if they were? The Constitution says you have a right to have your day in court, not a right to get rubbed out. There's no worry about that on the part of the government. And furthermore, American citizens don't care. You know, it doesn't make any difference to them. In an essay entitled America's Disappeared, posted on Truth Dig 18 July, Chris Hedges writes, torture, prolonged detention without trial, sexual humiliation, rape, disappearance, extortion, looting, random murder, and abuse have become, as in Argentina during the Dirty War, part of our own subterranean world of detention sites and torture centers. We know of at least 100 detainees who died during interrogation at our black sites. There are probably many more whose fate has never been made public. Tens of thousands of Muslim men have passed through our clandestine detention centers without due process. We tortured people unmercifully, admitted retired General Barry McCaffrey. We probably murdered dozens of them, both the armed forces and the CIA. So tens of thousands of Americans are being held in super maximum security prisons now, where they're deprived of contact with anyone and psychologically destroyed. Undocumented workers are rounded up, and they vanish from their families for weeks or months. Militarized police units break down the doors of some 40,000 Americans every year and haul them away in the dead of night as though they were enemy combatants. And, of course, as you know, habeas corpus no longer exists. Once again, Philip Green comments on this. A people that accepts as a normal course of events the bombing of civilians, torture, kidnapping, indefinite detention, assassinations, secret governments at home, and covert wars abroad has lost touch with the moral basis of civil society. Good description of us today, I think. Eight, the U.S. military, which soaks up 50% of the discretionary budget, is apparently unable to win two wars in two small countries. In fact, it has not had a serious victory since World War II, after which it decided to play it safe and stick to tin pot dictators and minor nations. Number nine, a U.S. intelligence report released in 2008 called Global Trends 2025, you can download it on the web, predicts a steady decline in American dominance over the coming decades, with U.S. leadership eroding, quote, an accelerating pace in political, economic, and cultural arenas. To my knowledge, the president has never mentioned this report, nor has anyone in public office. 10. On July 19th of 2010, the Washington Post reported that 854,000 people work for the National Security Agency, the NSA, in 33 building complexes amounting to 17 million square feet of space in the D.C. metro area. Every day, collection systems at the NSA intercept and store 1.7 billion emails and phone calls of American citizens in what amounts to a vast domestic spy system. Writing in The New Yorker on May 23rd of this year, Jane Meyer reported that the NSA has three times the budget of the CIA and has the capacity to download every 6 hours electronic communications equivalent to the entire contents of the Library of Congress. Every 6 hours. They also developed a program called Thin Thread that enables computers to scan the material for keywords. And they collect the billing records and the dialed phone numbers of everyone in the country. In violation of communications laws, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South were only too happy to open their electronic records to the government. I have to say that at the height of its insanity, the Stasi in East Germany, you know that film, Leben des Anderes, Lives of Others, was spying on one out of every seven citizens. The United States is now spying on seven out of every seven citizens. Everybody in this room, your emails, your phone calls, it's all recorded. 11, you can now go to jail in the United States simply for speaking. In late July of this year, environmental activist Tim DeChristopher was sentenced to 2 years in prison for his repeated declaration that environmental protection required civil, that is to say, nonviolent, disobedience. One wonders if the same judge, D. Benson, would have also put Rosa Parks and Mahatma Gandhi in jail had he been around during their lifetimes. Number 12, this is my favorite. This was also in July of this year. Somehow this was symbolic, it seemed to me, of what's happened to America in the last 60 years. Police in Georgia shut down a lemonade stand being run by three girls, aged 10 to 14, who were trying to save up money for a trip to a local water park. The police said that they didn't know what was in the lemonade. Acid trips. Right? And in addition, that the girls needed a business license, a peddler's permit, and a food permit in order to run the stand. It turns out that the permits cost $50 a day. You know, so kind of counterproductive as far as the girls were concerned. And finally, Baker's Dozen, number 13, the deepest locus of corruption, it seems to me, is the American soul. The sheer cruelty of the American people that now is starting to fill many articles. I have to say, again, it's a question of macrocosm and microcosm. On page 56 of Why America Failed, I wrote, as George Walden writes in his aptly titled study, God Won't Save America, Psychosis of a Nation. Quote, the peculiarities of nations, good and bad, tend to reflect the temperaments and qualities of their peoples. As Plato remarked, where else would they have come from? And at that point, when my editor, this, you know, several months ago, was working over the manuscript, at this point he wrote in the margin, this is the turning point of the book. You know, this is it. This is the hinge point of the whole thing. So, you know, as far as evidence for that goes, Jonathan Schell did an article in The Nation October 17th talking about some of the meetings for Republican candidates. Ron Paul had apparently said something like he would recommend that anybody who got sick and didn't have health insurance, you know, it's his risk after all. And Wolf Blitzer asked him, so he should just die? And that was the implication. And there were cheers from the crowd at this point. They roared in approval. They also applauded enthusiastically when Rick Perry, you know, reported that he had killed 200, the state of Texas had murdered 235 criminals on death row. That also brought, you know, enthusiastic cheers. There's so much of this material now. Most recently, there was an article in the New York Times about a law firm, Stephen J. Baum, located near Buffalo, New York. It's commonly referred to as a foreclosure mill firm. It does the dirty work for banks, you know, and evicting people and so on. And a year ago, Halloween, 2010, they had a Halloween party, and the staff showed up with their costumes being homeless people. They dressed as the people that they themselves evicted. Here are the pictures. I mean, so the people dirtied their faces, and they had signs, we'll work for food, and so this was funny to them. This was funny. Of course, the firm immediately denied it, but the pictures are online. You know, I mean, you know, deny away. As far as the data for this goes, this is anecdotal evidence. But the University of Michigan began a study on empathy among college students in 1979. It ran for 30 years, and the conclusion was that there was a 48% drop in empathy among college students and an inability to understand another person's point of view. Douglas Labeer, who is a therapist in Washington, D.C., calls this empathy deficit disorder, which he says is rife in the United States. After all, capital punishment is regarded as barbaric in Europe. 38 states in the U.S. have it with great support on the part of the population. And when somebody's executed, crowds typically show up with signs and say, "Die, you son of a bitch," and things like this, you know. Anyway, let me stop at 13 examples. It's probably quite enough. But, you know, just want to say that it seems to me that a harsh environment, which is the environment we live in, creates cruel people. Although he doesn't get into the issue of negative identity per se, the French writer Denis Duclos, who is a director of the CNRS, the Research Institute in Paris, pegged the problem of the obsession with having an enemy and the violence that results from that in his book of 1994, Le Complexe de Loup-Garou, The Werewolf Complex. In his epilogue to the 2005 edition, Duclos writes that America is always dependent on a werewolf figure, a dark, savage beast that's out to destroy it. And the beast, he says, changes in content, but the form is always the same. At the center of this, he says, is a terrible fear that Americans have of emptiness, which is an anxiety of not existing. And they disguise this with a hyperactive optimism. Have a nice day. A curious society, he writes, of people who don't know who they really are. Like the Romans, they see themselves under siege, and he says this could finally trigger a fascist populism, which, of course, we're seeing with the Tea Party. The American fear of the monster, he writes, has always marked its history, whether this exists on the inside or the outside. This leads to isolating the country in a sort of collective psychosis that can only contribute to international instability. In fact, that's how most of the world sees us. A few years ago, there was an international poll that asked the question, which nation do you believe is the greatest threat to world peace? The United States and Israel said Iran, and everybody else said the United States.
Morris Berman, speaking in November on the fundamental cause of America's problems and many of the world's problems. That cause is America's deepest beliefs, or lack of beliefs. And a good metaphor to describe the country's resulting behavior is the werewolf, which inspired me to dust off New World Notes' now little-used theme song, which happens to be Werewolves of London. You'll find a video of Berman's hour-long speech at Pirate TV Seattle. That's www.edmaysproductions.net. Or find a handy link to that at our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Till I get to my non-carborundum, and ciao.